loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke this morning at the Heritage Foundation and laid out demands for Iran. Speaking on behalf of the Trump administration, he promised to, quote, crush Iran. We'll talk about what those demands are, how doable they are, and whether this is a pretext or a prelude for military confrontation. And then Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro won a second six-year term yesterday in a popular election. Meanwhile, President Trump is considering an oil embargo on Venezuela, a move that could have a profound economic impact on the country and its people.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the online news site The Intercept reported over the weekend that an FBI informant who had allegedly infiltrated the Trump campaign in 2016 is the same person who oversaw a CIA operation in 1980 to infiltrate the Jimmy Carter campaign. He reportedly did so at the urging of former CIA Director George H.W. Bush. How is all of this legal? And is Donald Trump right when he says the FBI was spying on him? Next, at least 10 prominent women's activists were arrested in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and today, just 6 weeks before the kingdom was supposed to lift its ban on women driving. Two men also were arrested. The women have been outspoken in their support of a woman's right to drive and in their opposition to the male guardianship system, where a woman may travel only with the permission of her father, husband, or brother. The arrested men are known for having created a literary salon that allows both men and women to attend. The government said that the activists had, quote, formed a cell that threatened Saudi security, unquote. Then we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education around the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then we begin a new weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits, with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And finally, Kirill Vyshinsky, a reporter for RIA Novosti Ukraine, the Ukrainian bureau of the Russian news agency, was arrested in Kiev last week and charged with high treason. The Ukrainian government accuses Vyshinsky of, quote, subversion by means of information, unquote. The NGO Reporters Without Borders says that it is deeply worried about the journalist and is calling on the Ukrainian government to release him without delay. And in other headlines, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Russian President Vladimir Putin met today in the Russian city of Sochi. The two countries have been historical allies since India's independence from British colonial rule, but ties have recently been strained as India's right-wing government moves closer to the United States. The meeting is considered to be an informal summit without a set agenda, replicating the format of a recent meeting Modi held with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. U.S. and Chinese officials assured the public over the weekend that a truce had been reached in the incipient trade war between the two countries. Without specifying the details, U.S. officials announced that China had agreed to increase its purchases of U.S. goods to address the trade deficit, and in return would be freezing announced tariffs. Anti-China and trade protectionist rhetoric was a main feature of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. In Epic Systems versus Lewis, the Supreme Court ruled today that if a company requires its employees to sign away their rights to class action lawsuits, then the employee is only eligible for individual level suits, which are much less compelling. In this particular case, a common case of wage underpayment, Epic Systems underpaid employees but had them sign a waiver as a condition of employment requiring them to only sue alone and not in a class action. The wage theft in singular cases is so small that the cases are harder to arbitrate. Banding together in class action wage theft cases is much more effective for workers. Disgraced coal baron Don Blankenship, who recently served a year in prison for his role in the Upper Big Branch explosion that killed 29 miners, has announced that he intends to run in the West Virginia senatorial race as the nominee of the far-right-wing Constitution Party. Blankenship came in an embarrassing third place in the Republican primary election earlier this month. However, he faces a likely court battle due to a state law that prohibits the loser of a major party primary from switching affiliations to run in the general election. Those are today's headlines. Next up is Trump and Pompeo's Plan B on Iran. Stay tuned, you're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Mike Pompeo's speech on Iran. In his first major speech since becoming Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo outlined a number of new conditions that Iran must meet. One cannot look at this speech, hear the speech, read the speech, and not feel that this speech is intended to lay the groundwork for a confrontation between the United States and the Iranian government. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammad Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammad, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're there. You're in Iran. Quite a remarkable speech. What's your takeaway?
Well, I'm not very surprised because it is very similar to the sort of language that Trump and others surrounding him, like Bolton, have been using. I think that it is surprising in the sense that the Secretary of State, who is supposed to present the United States as a reasonable country, as a law-abiding country, as a civilized country, is doing the exact opposite. It's showing the United. He's showing the United States to be very unreasonable, very brutal. The whole notion of crushing a nation is something that you would expect some dictatorship from the Middle Ages or some Nazi leader or some other crude individual to use. That sort of language is not the language that any civilized human being uses when talking about a nation of 80 million people. But so that in that sense, it's surprising because I think what he's basically done is he's shown the international community what the Trump regime really stands for. It does not stand for international law. It does not stand for human rights. It does not stand for justice. It does not stand for human dignity. And I think he hurts the United States more than anyone else, though I don't think he recognizes that.
I know that you're not here in Washington, Mohammad. I know that you're not an employee of the State Department or the White House. But do you think that there's anybody in this administration who thinks that there's any real chance that Iran is going to do any of these things? Or is this just meant to prepare the American people for the possibility of hostilities?
I don't know what they really think. I doubt any person who has any real knowledge of Iran believes that Iran will accept any of these conditions. It's no country that has any degree of independence or dignity would accept such demands, let alone a country like Iran that has fought for its independence and its dignity for 4 decades now. I find it difficult to believe that the United States is heading or is willfully heading towards military confrontation, because I think they recognize that Iran is nothing compared. It's incomparable to Iraq or Libya or Yemen or any of these other countries that the United States has destroyed. It is a very powerful country. It has very powerful allies across the region. It has enormous defense capabilities, and the Persian Gulf region is, is more or less controlled by Iran. If the Iranians don't want oil to exit the Persian Gulf region, there will be no oil exiting the Persian Gulf. So I think the Americans know that there is a sort of balance of terror between the two sides. Not that Iran is as powerful as the United States, obviously not, but Iran is strong enough to make the Americans lose tremendously. And it would be a lost war for the United States, far worse than anything that they've experienced before. So I don't think that they are intentionally moving in that direction. But what they are doing is dangerous because it could actually take us to military confrontation.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about that. We talked, as I've mentioned before, with Lawrence Wilkerson, who is Colin Powell's chief of staff. We talked to him on this show. And, you know, I had been following Iraq a lot. I had been going back and forth to Iraq. We were bringing medicine to Iraq. We were, for more than a decade, looking at Iraq's compliance with the international weapons monitoring regime that existed there. And it was quite clear that to anybody, even a casual observer, that Iraq posed no menace to any country in 2002 or 2003. It was hobbled. It was suffering economically. It was surrounded. It didn't have weapons of mass destruction. It just wanted some economic relief. So I asked Wilkerson, well, so why did the Bush administration invade? Because you know that too. Everybody knew that who was actually paying attention. And he said, well, because it was the low-hanging fruit, meaning it was going to be an easy operation to topple the government. And Iran is not an easy operation, as Mohammad Mirandi is saying. In fact, it may be an impossible situation militarily. There's no clear reason to think the U.S. would actually win the war. And so that's not it. It seems to me, though, that by laying down all of these markers that are, in fact, impossible for Iran to meet, and at the same time, Pompeo is saying every country in the world must succumb, must go along with us, meaning the European signers and perhaps the Russian and Chinese signers of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, they too must go along or they too will be punished. It's setting the stage for the full court press against Iran to destabilize their economy and deprive them access to the world market. Mohammed, you see it that way?
I think that that's the objective. But I think what he's really doing is that he's making the world dislike, if not despise, the United States. The Russians, the Chinese, and other countries recognize that the United States government, and I say this with all due respect to your listeners, that the United States government is a rogue regime, that it's a menace, and that there needs to be a mechanism developed to prevent it from behaving in this manner. So I think basically they are enhancing or strengthening those forces that would potentially wish to unite to stop the United States. I mean, the Russians definitely will be looking and saying, well, if the Americans succeed Iran with Iran, then we're next. The Russians then, if they come under an assault by the United States, forget their nuclear weapons, but the Chinese will then say, well, then we're next. So I think that, and even the Europeans feel insulted, they feel abused. The Americans have insulted their president, the president of France, the chancellor of Germany, when they went to the United States and they were ridiculed and ignored. And then when they went back, the American government basically dictated to them that you do as we say. And I don't think that's going to go down well with Europe. And I think all countries will start thinking that, well, then we have to prohibit the United States from exerting this sort of influence in future. Because what the United States is now doing is it's engaging in war with Iran. It is by crushing Iran, they mean the U.S. government means that they want to crush 80 million people. That's the objective. The objective is to bring about hunger. The objective is to prevent Iranians from having medicine. It's to create misery, for people to lose jobs, to fall into poverty. I'm sure there are some Americans, I'm not going to hide this fact, I'm sure that there are quite a few Americans that would take pleasure in this. But I don't think that the overwhelming majority really deep down would ever contemplate such a thing as being representative of their values. But I think the mainstream media in the United States is guilty of all, and they're as deeply guilty as the current administration, because for 40 years they've demonized Iran, despite the fact that the United States overthrew the Iranian government in 1953 and imposed a dictatorship, despite the fact that they helped create the secret police that tortured and killed thousands of people, and they supported the Shah. They supported Saddam Hussein, gave him chemical weapons to use against Iranians, killing many thousands of Iranians with chemical weapons. This is not 50 years ago. This is just 3 decades ago. They imposed sanctions for decades. The United States is responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of Iranians over the last few decades. Yet the Western media, the American media, has always antagonized Iran, always caricatured Iran, always try to present Iran in a way which made it seem as some enemy in the eyes of ordinary Americans. And I'm sure many Americans who, some Americans at least, who are listening to your show may feel that way as we speak and say Iran deserves it because of all the propaganda, because of Hollywood, because of the news against Iran. But the reality on the ground is that the relationship between Iran and the United States is between a country that has tried to impose its will on another country for decades and a country that has been resisting American hegemony. This has been the issue between the United States and Iran from day one.
You know, this is a very important point too, Brian, that Mohammed raises. Words are important. Words have meaning. And there are some words that in this great international context, you can't utter because they constitute a crime. And I think this is my own personal opinion. I'm not an international attorney, but you know, I've been for much of my adult life in these diplomatic circles. I think it's a crime to give a speech like this, where you're threatening to crush, and that was the word, to crush a sovereign
country.
It's
against the UN Charter, right?
It's a violation of the UN Charter, which has the force of international law.
Yeah, and the U.S. is a signatory, well, tell me if I'm wrong about this, signatory to the U.N. Charter as a treaty obligation, correct?
That's right, and because it's been approved by the U.S. Senate, it has the force of domestic law inside the United States.
Yeah, in the U.S. Constitution, a treaty is, quote, the highest law of the land.
That's right.
So if you're violating the U.N. Charter explicitly, you're violating, it's a crime, it's a domestic crime as well as an international
Indeed
crime.
Indeed it is.
And the other thing that Mohammed is pointing out, and I think the long-term big picture, it may be the most important, is how, you know, the post-World War II world order that the U.S. created, whereby both its allies and defeated adversaries in World War II were rehabilitated and sort of turned into junior partners of the United States with certain spoken and unspoken, you know, understandings. Some of that world order is unraveling right now. Listen to Donald Tusk, the head of the EU, former prime minister of Poland. Here's what he said about what the U.S. is doing towards Iran. Quote, looking at the latest decisions of Donald Trump, someone could even think, with friends like that, who needs enemies? But frankly speaking, Europe should be grateful to President Trump, because thanks to him, we got rid of all the illusions. He has made us realize that if you need a helping hand, you will find one at the end of your arm. These would not have been imaginable declarations by the head of the EU 16 months ago. Go ahead, Mohammed.
That's true, although I have serious doubts about the will of the Europeans to stand up to the U.S. government. And I have serious doubts about whether internal resistance in the United States can get its act together. And I think it's upon the Iranian people to stand up for their own rights. And ironically, what Trump has done is he's united Iranians in a way that I've never seen before. I've never seen the focus of the Iranian. I mean, in Iran, you always have conflict between different parties, different political factions, people with different views. But for the first time, there's a universal consensus that Trump is the enemy. And unfortunately, many Iranians have a dislike for the United States. And this is something rather new, actually. In the past, ever since polling began in Iran on these issues, there's always been a relatively high dislike towards the U.S. government. But most Iranians like the American people. For the first time, since polling, it's the dislike towards the United States government is almost 100%, and it's basically directed towards Trump. But also for the first time, the majority, it's less than 50%, but somewhere like I don't know, but it's the majority of those who took sides now have a dislike for the United States, and I think it's obviously because of Trump, because many Iranians somehow think that since he was elected by American people, or at least a large minority of Americans, that somehow he reflects the will of the American people. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, most Iranians would recognize that Americans have very little understanding of Iran because they are entrapped in the narrative of the mainstream media. and the mainstream media has been demonizing Iran for four decades. I mean, when the Israelis massacre Palestinians, they support the Israelis. When the United States supports extremists in Syria, leading to the rise of ISIS, no one in the United States knows that. And if you tell them that, they'll say this is nonsense until you start showing them the evidence, the Defense Intelligence Agency documents of 2012 and the other things that you know as well as I. So this is a very sad situation. But I think that what Trump and Pompeo are doing is that they're making people across the board recognize this. People across Europe will definitely dislike the United States government. I think the majority. I'm sure there are right-wing extremists everywhere, but I think the mainstream dislikes the United States government, and I think that's true in Asia and in Latin America. People are seeing people like Pompeo and Trump behaving as, I don't know, the Godfather.
Yeah. So Mohammed, what will if the Europeans capitulate? And I hear you about that. I mean, the French oil company Total has also already said that. Because they do a lot of business in the U.S., that they can't take a chance of continuing to follow through with their contractual obligations to develop Iranian oil fields. There's been others in Europe, including British oil companies, that are, I think, ready to jump in. And certainly the Chinese and maybe Russians would be probably glad to take their place. But we don't know for certain how this will all play out. But just assume that European governments or the European corporations that provide the real constituency for those governments, if they decide to capitulate to the United States so that they have access to the U.S. market rather than be shut out from it, what will be the impact economically on Iran?
I'm sure it's going to be difficult. But first of all, as I'm sure you know, that will be the end of the agreement. Iran will exit the nuclear agreement. So it's really up to the Europeans. It's their choice. If they have the backbone, if they grow a backbone, if they have the will, if they make firm commitments, then Iran will stick with the agreement. If not, then Iran is going to leave within the next few weeks. But without a doubt, it's going to be difficult for Iran. But at the same time, it's also going to be difficult for the United States. First of all, Iran is, I think, without a doubt, is going to finally shift east. Iran is going to change its relationship with the Chinese and the Russians, especially the Chinese, because the relationship with the Russians has already evolved a great deal because of their similar stance on Syria and also the fact that both countries are facing U.S. sanctions. But the Chinese are also facing a lot of antagonism, and they know that if Iran, for any reason, is seriously hurt, that has implications for them as well. So I think that the U.S. government is doing China a big favor and the Russians a big favor, and anyone else who's will shift towards Iran. But I think that it will be a transition era. The Iranian government, though, will have the advantage that the overwhelming majority of the people will look to the United States as the aggressor, and they won't blame the government, even though there's a lot to blame. I mean, there's incompetence, there's corruption, like everywhere else in the world. But that will be no longer an issue. People will rally behind the government in the face of the United States, because the way in which Pompeo and Trump conduct themselves, or Bolton, it's obvious that they're the enemy. And it's obvious that they're a ruthless and brutal and barbaric enemy. And that the only way to answer that sort of enemy is resistance. And that resistance ultimately can manifest itself militarily. That's what I think Trump doesn't recognize, that he is pushing the United States towards a situation where there could be a military conflict. I don't think that's what the United States wants, but that could help. That could happen. And Iran has very, very powerful friends across the board in the region. And this is something that the United States has to take note of. Iran has very powerful allies in Iraq. It has very powerful allies in Afghanistan. It has very powerful allies in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Yemen, and in countries like Bahrain. And I don't think that the United States recognizes that they are vulnerable everywhere in this region. So it would be utterly foolish for the United States to go down the road of greater confrontation, because the more you go down that road, the more unpredictable the situation becomes. And if there is a military conflict, I mean, it would be utterly foolish for anyone to think that the United States can win this war. There's no way that the United States will win. Everyone would lose, but the United States would lose.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. didn't win Korea, didn't win in Vietnam. Iran, no. 80 million people.
Yep. I mean, look at the size of Iran compared to Iraq or compared to Afghanistan. And look at how many years we've been in this never-ending war in those two countries. This is something that American policymakers don't understand. And I fear that most American citizens don't understand that you can't just wantonly attack another country and think that everybody is going to live happily ever after.
Mohammed, let me follow up with you on that, because as you said, the U.S. doesn't necessarily want a war, or maybe absolutely doesn't want a war. It just wants to pursue this very aggressive policy to weaken Iran. But how would a war possibly happen? What would be the scenario?
Well, if, for example, Pompeo, what he said, if he's serious and he tries to arrest or kill Iranians outside of Iran, then I think it would only be natural for Iranians to retaliate. Because at the end of the day, if the United States is seen as killing Iranians or arresting Iranians, or taking Iranians hostage, then the Iranians know that the only way to stop it would be to retaliate. And that could lead to a further escalation. Or, for example, if the Americans try to harass Iranians in the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf is a very small area. Half of the oil exports across the world, oil and gas exports, almost come from this region. If there was violence, then that would be the end of the global economy. Oil would go up to God knows how much. And, you know, there would be a global economic meltdown. There's no way that the United States could prevent that from happening. Iran has prepared itself for 15 years now, ever since 2003. The Iranians have been preparing themselves for an attack from the United States. That's why they built up a missile defense system. It's because of the regular threats that Bush and Obama and now Trump have been making. So, and Iran's military defense capabilities today are far more advanced and developed than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's a foolish move, and it's a very arrogant move. It's sort of like the empire saying, you know, we're going to crush the resistance, or we're going to crush, you know, our antagonists. But it's not as simple as that. And again, I it's not just Iran. The repercussions will be in Iraq, they'll be in Afghanistan, they'll be in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen. It's something that the Americans, and they can't win. And then the Americans have rivals like China and Russia that will be empowered by U.S. involvement in such a major conflict.
Yeah, imperial arrogance, hubris, the arrogance of power on display again today in Washington, D.C., with the speech by Mike Pompeo. Nobody, no other government or no other government leaders talk like the American government leaders talk. It's amazing. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. Mohammed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In this segment, we're going to be speaking with Carlos Ron. He is the charge d'affaires at the Venezuelan Embassy in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about the presidential elections that took place yesterday in Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro, the current president, the incumbent, won the vote. The opposition was badly divided, some carrying out a boycott of the election. Of course, the United States government, even before the election, said that the election itself was another expression that Venezuela is, in fact, a dictatorship, which, of course, seems incongruent on its face since it was having an election and Maduro could have lost. Nonetheless, it's part of the hostile media coverage directed towards Venezuela. But at the same time, the U.S. government is preparing for new measures designed to hobble Venezuela's economy, including the prospects for a U.S.-imposed boycott of Venezuelan oil. Carlos Ron, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
First of all, let's talk about the election. The voter turnout was low, lower than in the past. Nicolas Maduro, however, did win a very convincing victory. Talk about your take on it.
Well, you got to think that, put into context, that these elections have perhaps been the most difficult ones for the Venezuelan population since the beginning of the Bolivarian Revolution in 1999. I mean, you have to think that the people went to vote despite having threats of, you know, more U.S. Coercive measures against Venezuela, of possible retaliation of some sort. I mean, in the past, we've seen violence and the call for the more extreme groups of the opposition was not to participate and to actually, you know, promote other ways of getting overturning the results, overturning President Maduro's presidency by alternative measures and constitutional measures. So at the end of the day, despite the difficult circumstances that the financial blockade, the economic sabotage from part of the opposition has taken place, there was a substantial amount, a significant amount of people that went out to vote and to defend the Bolivarian Revolution, to defend their social the social programs that the Bolivarian Revolution has upheld, and to try to maintain the same orientation government.
Were you pleased, unpleased with the way the vote turned out? I mean, obviously Maduro won, so you have to be pleased about that. But in terms of the numbers and what you're looking at in terms of where the votes came, what they showed, what were there any things that you found surprising in yesterday's election?
No, I think actually I was well, I felt very relieved by the turnout, Brian, because as I said, you know, if you think about it, what we've been facing the last couple of months have been the most vicious type of attacks internationally. I mean, you see, for example, when you think about the actions that have been taking place, diplomatic actions that have some sort of effect on the Venezuelan population. You think about how difficult it is for the government to actually campaign when every government program is sort of being attacked and sabotaged by all these actions. For example, we've all admitted that we have a problem. We've had a problem recently with food distribution for getting food to the people of Venezuela. And then when you realize that part of the campaign against President Maduro was blocking, you know, the food for coming in. There was an advisory from FinCEN, which is part of the Department of Treasury, that came out last year in September that specifically tells banks that they should be aware, they should be careful about Venezuelan money, that transactions involving the Venezuelan government or Venezuelan state enterprises could be the product of corruption. So that has led to banks, you know, taking actions such as blocking Venezuelan payments for things such as food. If they find, you know, part of the actual wording of this advisory says that transactions involving the Venezuelan government contracts are directed to companies that operate in an unrelated line of business, they could be subjected to further review and or even, you know, some sort of stopping of the flow of the money. So when we've tried to make some payments in specific items, food items, they have been blocked. Last week, if you see one of the Twitter feed of President Santos in Colombia, he actually claims, as if it was something to be proud of, that he blocked the entrance of 400 tons of food from the CLAP programs that the government is giving out, and they blocked the entry of this food into Venezuela. So when you look at the larger context, the fact that people came out to vote despite, you know, all these attacks from outside, of this attempt to make the Venezuelan people suffer, it is remarkable, a remarkable vote of confidence in President Maduro and you know, a show of support.
You know, I'm wondering, too, if you can tell us what the relationship is like on a personal level between the Venezuelan government and the State Department. Do you feel that you get the respect that you deserve as a as a trading partner, whether or not there are political problems between the United States and Venezuela, I think is a separate issue. But as a trading partner, do you feel that you're respected when you go into the State Department and speak to them?
Look, I think it's a difficult relationship because sometimes the tone in which we're addressed is a tone of imposition, a tone of trying to also to obtain something from us, but in not in a respectful way. You know, something that we've been trying to do for a while is have a respectful relationship of dialogue. I think, if anything, the President Maduro has shown throughout all his tenure is that he's a man that's open to dialogue and has called for dialogue, not only in Venezuela with the internal opposition, but also with the United States. And, you know, he has offered even to speak to President Trump on the phone. And, you know, the reply we got, I didn't even get a personal response from anybody in the State Department, but I got, there was a statement coming out from the White House saying that, you know, there's no way that he would talk to President Maduro. So you see there's no, it's a difficult sort of communication in those terms. I think that it's difficult still to my, from my perspective, for the department or from the U.S. government in general to understand that when they talk to Venezuela, they're talking to a sovereign government. They're talking to an independent government, to an independent country, to independent people, and they're not talking to somebody who they could tell what to do here and there.
In light of that, are you getting any kind of an inkling as to what the administration intends vis-a-vis this proposed oil embargo? The United States buys so much of the oil that Venezuela produces. It seems to me that it would be a catastrophe if that relationship, the trade relationship, were to end. Are you getting any kind of a feel for what the U.S. government intends to do here?
Look, I really can't tell you what they would be willing to do. Again, I think that, like we've always said, unilateral sanctions or what we call coercive measures, which is what they really are, they're not really, they're not something that we find legal, and they're not something that would in any way promote dialogue or understanding between the two countries. I know there's a lot of interest as well in this country, business interests, that there's American companies that have a stake in Venezuela and that have had actually a good relationship with the Venezuelan government or the PDVSA, which is a state-owned oil company. And, you know, that's a relationship that would be endangered if any of these actions were to take place. You know, it's difficult to see what the intent are, but it's also worrisome what some of the statements coming from U.S. governments are. I mean, not so long ago when Secretary Tillerson was still in state, he came to Latin America and on the Venezuela issue, remembered how at one point these things were solved by the military. You know, these problems, were sort of solved by military, and that's the same thing that you'll hear somebody like Senator Rubio say when he asks, when he states that if, you know, the Venezuelan military would do something to overthrow President Maduro, then that would be applauded by him or by somebody else around the world. Or when even National Security Council director for Western Hemisphere, Juan Cruz, you know, also hinted to something to that effect a couple of weeks ago. So we don't know what they want to do, and we hope that that's not the action, the course of action. Again, so I think what we need to understand in order for us to progress in this hemisphere is to really respect each other and respect the will of the people. I mean, what we had yesterday was an election. I could understand when at a time where you have people protest in countries that there are no elections, and then you're trying to, you know, see that promote democracy. But what is sort of bizarre, even for the U.S. Discourse, is that you're actually condemning a country for having elections. You're actually trying to punish people that go and participate in those elections. So what is your other option then? How do you claim to be defending democracy when what you're asking is no elections, but rather you're praising or some sort of trying to get people to do a coup and see that that's something that's positive in any way? So there's got to be some more sincerity coming out from each part.
That's the voice of Carlos Ron. Carlos is the chargé d'affaires at the Venezuelan embassy here in Washington, D.C., thus the lead diplomat for Venezuela here in Washington. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Carlos, the price of oil is going up. It went way, way down from, I can't remember what it was at its height a few years ago, but it was like somewhere like $110 or $120, some very per barrel. And then it dropped below, I think below $40 per barrel, maybe even below $30, I'm not sure. Now it's about $80 per barrel. Venezuelan oil is expensive to harvest and perhaps to refine as well. Nonetheless, an increase in oil prices for a country that is dependent on oil should be beneficial. And of course, President Chavez used oil revenues, unlike earlier governments, for the benefit of masses of people. I mean, there was this social investment, the investment of massive numbers of new houses for poor people and for people who were barely surviving. In this case, and under these circumstances, and I think if you could help us understand it, too, there's been, I think, over the past year or two, a reduction in the amount of oil that's being produced in Venezuela. And you have all of these other sort of adversarial relations thrown up by the United States in terms of the world market and world trade. But will the increase in the price of oil benefit Venezuela right now? And if so, how much under these particular circumstances?
Well, there's different things here. First of all, I think obviously when the price goes up, it is beneficial for a country producing oil. So we will have to see eventually some relief, and that's something positive. However, I think that we have to understand that first of all, the period of time where the prices were low, so we have things to take care of. That so we're sort of from that period where there wasn't such a high price. So that's something that we need to look into. But also the difficulties that Venezuela now faces given the coercive measures by the United States. For example, debt renegotiation is something that is forbidden explicitly in the last August measures that were taken against Venezuela. So that places the limitations on how much we can try to address our problems. You also have specific limitations on CITGO, which is owned by PDVSA, and it's an American company owned by PDVSA, and its dividends used to be part of part of the cash flow that Venezuela had to purchase, you know, everyday needs for people. So that's also being blocked. No dividends from CITGO are going back to Venezuela since last year. So even when we have the prospects of some positive news with the rise of price, you have to take into account that there are other things that are also making it difficult for Venezuela to move forward.
Yeah, and again, just so I don't really know off the top of my head, where is Venezuelan oil mainly sold? Is it mainly here?
The U.S. is a very important market. We have other markets that are important as well, such as China and other commerce throughout the region. The U.S. represents a very important part of our market as well.
And so if the U.S. were to impose a boycott of Venezuelan oil, what will you do? What will Venezuela do? Is it about with China? I mean, there has to be some other workaround, even though none of them are going to be as convenient or as cost-effective as trading with the United States, which is a virtual neighbor.
No, and definitely would not be something easy to do, especially when you have the U.S. also promoting other countries to take similar actions against Venezuela. So, look, this is the thing. Countries have made up their minds when they become independent and when they achieved a strong democracy like we have. I think at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is defend our right to exist and our right to self-determination. That cannot be something that that we could be pressured into renouncing. I think that the decision made by the Venezuelan people would be to try to find other ways. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, is trying to find other partners in the region, outside the region. And like you said, you mentioned China. We've had a good trade relationship with Russia as well, with India and other countries around the world. But at the end of the day, you know, we cannot be blackmailed, or we cannot, you know, just let ourselves be blackmailed by the threats of an embargo. I think what's important here is that we need to have the right of Venezuelans be respected to take their own decisions. And that's the key factor. I think the Venezuelan people have been struggling during the past months with facing some economic hardships, and they have found inventive ways to get around them. You know, when some of the things, some of the imports have been blocked, you see Venezuelan cooperatives, you know, producing locally, trying to find alternative sources of products to make everyday lives, more livable. So if this is something that we have to face, I think this is something we will have to face, but definitely with the spirit of maintaining our independence and our sovereignty.
Yeah, we're speaking with Carlos Ron. He is the lead diplomat here in Washington, D.C. at the embassy in Venezuela. I do want you to help our audience here in Washington, D.C. and around the United States to understand the difference in the approach to oil revenue usage for Venezuela. I mean, Venezuela was a capitalist country. 70% of the land was owned by less than 1% of the people. The divide between a minority of affluent people and very, very, very poor people was hugely significant. So you had a country like other countries that are large oil producers, a lot of oil wealth. And yet the oil wealth was basically being used for the fantabulous lifestyle of the rich and famous and not for the poor. Chavez changed that. And, you know, because of all the hostile, you know, coverage in the corporate-owned media, Chavez was targeted. He was branded all kinds of things. It made it look as if Venezuela was kind of unraveling, but it was unraveling as a consequence of an economic and social policy. But those social policies actually made a major improvement in the lives of millions of people. Just talk about what actually happened and how Chavez's perspective on oil revenues and how it should be used, how it differed.
Well, first of all, there was a difference of concepts here. I mean, the PDVSA that we used to have before President Chavez came into power was a company basically that acted as if it was a private company, and there, you know, the money would go back into the company, but never really meet any of the needs of the Venezuelan people. What changed the paradigm that changed was that, look, if this is state owned, if this is actually something that belongs to all Venezuelans together, why aren't all Venezuelans, or at least most Venezuelans, benefited from these revenues? And then that's when the decision was made to, you know, specifically take the revenues and invest them in, you know, education, housing, healthcare, in making important trade deals with other countries where, you know, the basis would be solidarity and see how we can complement each other rather than compete. And for example, I'm thinking of Cuba, for example, how, you know, oil in Cuba or oil for Venezuelan oil in Cuba was exchanged for medical expertise. I mean, medical doctors that came to Venezuela that went to the low income communities or inner city communities or even rural places where there had not been access to doctors before. So it was an important concept that, you know, that when the wealth is owned collectively, then it has to be enjoyed collectively, and it has to be put to everyone's benefit. And that has been. Until now, the premise, and there have been problems. You know, something that doesn't come in the news, and has to do with what you were talking about, the lower production that PDVSA has had in a more recent time has also been due to corruption. But nobody's telling you now in any of the mainstream media how Venezuela is fighting that corruption, PDVSA. How, since the new Attorney General Tarek William Saab, who became who's appointed by the National Constituent Assembly, has been running a strong campaign against corruption in PDVSA and trying to set that in motion and you know, try to help the company also by fighting corruption, but also being able to pick up their production levels. It's something important that has been that is being addressed by President Maduro, and nobody's taking into consideration. Just a final note: you know, despite all the difficulties that we've had in the last couple of years, the housing programs have been moving quickly. In 2010, we realized that we needed about we had a 3 million home deficit. And public housing has started with a special program for that implemented by President Chavez that has been continued under President Maduro. By now, we have over 2 million of those homes already built and given to, you know, lower income families to enjoy. So, again, it shows you how Venezuela can develop with its wealth, with its oil wealth, when it's distributed in fairly.
Just on that, how does it work with the 2 million people? You have 2 million low-income people. Are they literally given houses?
There's different modalities, but in many cases, look, the first group of people were people that were a group of families, you should say, were first given homes when their homes fell down in one of the strong rain season that we had. These were people that live in shantytowns, basically on the hills in and around Caracas, and they lost
mudslides,
exactly, and then they lost their homes, and they were giving these homes because they didn't have a home to go to, so they were giving these apartments to live, and now these are apartments that are given to a family, not to a single person, but they're given to a family, and makes it's a policy where you're trying to secure the family's well-being and guarantee them a home for years to come.
I want to ask you about a couple of sentences that were in a New York Times article about Venezuela today. It says that the country, of course, suffers from widespread food shortages, a collapsing healthcare system, inflation approaching 13,000%, and a mass exodus of Venezuelans moving to neighboring Colombia and Brazil. So the elections are behind us now. How does the government go about addressing these problems?
Well, I think that's an important issue. You know, first of all, there's a huge distortion on many of the mainstream media because there's an intent there that is important to point out. There's an intent to portray Venezuela as a country in a sort of crisis that is not just, you know, a price issue scarcity issue in one place or another, but that is they want to portray Venezuela as in the middle of a humanitarian crisis. And I use that term specifically because the definition of humanitarian crisis allows or gives the impression to the international community that the country has to be intervened from outside. So this is something that has been building up in the narrative, both in the mainstream media and as well by other political actors, because what they're looking for really is intervention in Venezuela. So the first issue is to say, you know, the portrayal that you see in mainstream media, the inflation rates that they're giving, and they are based, they have no base on real numbers, but there are, you know, calculations that are made precisely to, you know, attack the country. That distortion, we first have to realize that we're talking about distortion of reality. Then the second issue is to recognize we do have some problems and we do need to address them. And we have been addressing them. But again, it's kind of hard to address issues of healthcare when, for example, you have the malaria medicines that are mainly produced in Colombia. And then we make a purchase of about 2 million vaccines so that they can be distributed to the population. And then you have the Colombian government under influence from Treasury here block the sale of these medicines. And we have to run around as fine as maybe if India can sell us some of the medicine in time and so forth.
Right.
And then you create, this is something that's fabricated, but it's not something that is necessarily the fault of the government. And the government, what it's trying to do is trying to, you know, responsibly attend to these issues. If you have a blockade, a financial blockade, if you have a political attack that is aimed at not letting Venezuela have access to food, to medicine, it's very difficult for us to confront. Those are the challenges that we have been facing. You know, we've told some people that, you know, we're not really asking for humanitarian aid. We're not asking for people to send medicine. We're asking you to let our money in the banks, that is legitimate Venezuelan state money, be employed in purchasing what we need to purchase to make sure that our people have what they need.
You know, it's a tried and true tactic of the United States. The U.S. did this all over Latin America where progressive governments were formed. It continues to do so. We did it with Cuba. The blockade of Cuba is a blockade because third parties were also punished and penalized if they allowed Cuba to do trade or have access to credit. So the U.S. didn't have to just set up ships around the island of Cuba in order to create a blockade. They could use financial tools and economic tools. They did this in Chile in 1970 to 73. They created a massive, Kissinger called it, or somebody called it, make the economy scream, right? That was the slogan of the American government at that time. And it did scream. And the middle class in particular, poor people are used to not having anything, but middle class people are used to having something. And if they don't have something, if their lifestyle goes down, if their standard of living goes down, they get angry and they blame the government. And so the U.S. having this coercive power has created an environment once again to destabilize another Latin American country and to say then, look, see, they tried all these social programs. They failed. They're corrupt. They're inefficient. And yes, there is corruption. Of course, there's inefficiency. But if you look at Venezuela and abstract Venezuela's problems from the reality of the world situation it's facing, and that situation has been carefully calibrated or orchestrated, choreographed by the United States, you don't really understand much. But then again, in our last minute, Carlos, what's next for Venezuela? What will the government do right away? Because this is a big victory for Maduro. Gives a little bit of momentum now. What comes next?
Well, Brian, and just to circle that idea, but that's exactly what you when you were asking in the beginning if what we thought about the results is that, and it's precisely that, you know, given even within that context, even within the tactics that were used against Chile, you know, when the fact that, you know, about 6 million Venezuelans came out to vote and to support the revolution is very significant, and that's a mandate for President Maduro now. To come out and take more appropriate measures. He's already said that he will take, you know, make the economy something that's of his priority to tend to these issues right now. And, you know, that would be the next steps that he mentioned last night in his speech. And also, very importantly, a call to national reconciliation because, you know, he understands that what we need to move forward is to have an understanding and to come together as a country and to see how we could, you know, solve our differences democratically and move on these actions of sabotage and try to find a way to actually make Venezuela productive, strong, and that can maintain its social policies to take care of the people.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Carlos Ron. Carlos is the charge d'affaires at the Venezuelan Embassy in Washington, D.C., the lead diplomat of Venezuela here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.